Hello and welcome to the Monocle Summer Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On the programme today, we'll be keeping things sunny with a culinary tour up Tuscany's secret silver coast. Food writer and cook Emiko Davis will be leading the way, filling us in on the best Italian summer recipes and her book, Acquacotta.
We'll also be hearing from the musician Sena Chen about their new EP, Dive, and why trying to write songs with a summer feel can be as unpredictable as the British weather.
And we'll be joined by Monocle's food and travel editor, Josh Fennett, to learn what's in this week's edition of the Monocle Summer Weekly newspaper.
That's all coming up, plus Bill Lutie will be bringing us next week's news as well, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Nice to be back in the Monocle Weekly chair.
No, no more agreeable Sunday lunch partner than you, Robert Bound.
It's going to be good today. We've got a bit of a foodie theme, right? I mean, and this is good. We were calling this a summer. This is nominally the Monocle Summer Weekly, which is sort of to chime in with this lovely newspaper that we're putting to bed each week and indeed selling.
Get your copy now from all the newsstand.
Because there are fires that need, there are barbecues that need lighting all around the world, and I can't recommend anything
it's
higher
very
than using the Monocle Weekly,
very flammable.
Summer Weekly to light them with. And also we've got a food theme on this show, right? We've actually got a bona fide, wonderful Italian cook.
100%. I can't wait to take our listeners up the Tuscan coast a bit later, Rob.
What sort of vessel would you be using to take our listeners up?
Probably
the coast?
A canoe.
Good, well, I'm glad. I would use something similar as well. Will you be paddling it? What would you be paddling it with? Just two large ciabattas?
Big old. Yeah, a couple of oars. I don't know. Who knows?
Who knows? There's
ciabatta
no way of knowing.
One big ciabatta.
We can ask our guest, can't we? Emiko Davis, the eminent cook.
I'm looking forward to speaking to her later. Josh Fennett as well, our heavy-set colleague from the editorial floor, will be here. And I don't know how to describe this. He's going to be telling us about milk.
What sort of vessel do you think he would be going up the Tuscan coast in?
Probably a, what are those things called, milk flag, those big flagons, the old-fashioned ones that the milkmaids carry over their shoulders on a suspended from a piece of wood. What is
that's
that?
That's a really good question. Big milk, I suppose a milk churn.
A churn, that's
yeah.
What he'd be in.
Okay, right.
Oversized one, though.
Okay, fine. Well, let's find out if that's true, and if both of our guests fail to land a punch on the end of your nose, Tom. But first, it's another McColleague. It's Bill Lutie with next week's news. Which way you going, Billy? Can I go too? Which way you going, Billy? Can I go with you? What's on next week's news agenda today, Bill?
Before you start, I heard you talk. Before we start, I heard you talking about culinary traditions. Mm-hmm. And on my way into work today, I saw something glorious. You know, the building site just next to work. There was a guy stood out there, presumably having his breakfast, and he'd rolled up a hula hoop packet and tied a knot in the middle to make like a, you know, you can make like a sort of gun stick thing. And he was eating a Muller fruit corner with the packet of crisps.
Wow. He's like Ray. He's like an urban Ray Mears.
Urban Ray Mears. That's impressive.
Right?
Yeah, and
that's
like,
amazing.
That guy's got it.
He's got class as well.
Yeah.
In spades. What was he using as a napkin?
Just maybe the other side.
Another, right wrist.
Some like quavers.
Sleeve. Definitely just a sleeve.
Okay.
We've had like, there's been like a news drought.
Thank God for that.
Over the past few weeks. But. Yep. I think things are finally kicking in.
It's silly season over.
Well,
we're heading for September, aren't we?
And all the politicians go back to work. Everyone starts to think about serious things again rather than just like...
My only period of news I like is August. Well, no, because it does. You have a different perspective on the world, don't you? Rather than pretending that what politicians do is endlessly fascinating and important.
Pickled cucumber season.
Pickled cucumbers.
They call it in Germany,
give me that
apparently.
Any day. That's very good. Very good for settling the stomach, the vinegar. As well.
Well, anyway,
that's of no moment.
Let's pretend that we're interested in what politicians are doing.
Sorry, Bill, yeah.
Very important to us here in the UK.
Yeah.
Brexit negotiations are supposed to kick off again tomorrow.
Again? Have they kicked off at all?
Well, they're supposed to, like, they're just back, aren't they? They're back in the room to talk about stuff.
Yeah.
Both sides have said they want to speed things up because it's just taking too long. So they're going to have more meetings, apparently. So there'd be more of
this.
We're
sort of having meetings about meetings at the moment,
just
aren't we?
Just meeting.
We're in that stage.
But there's a little bit of goss. I quite like this.
Okay.
David Davis, our Brexit secretary.
Yeah.
Apparently, he doesn't do overtime. No.
He's liked on the work.
Bit of a clock watcher.
Yeah, man after my own heart.
And tomorrow, here in the UK, a glorious bank holiday. Not in Europe. Sorry. So they've summoned him. Michel Barnier has summoned David Davis and said, we're starting tomorrow. I worked on Bastille Day. You're going to work on
jolly well work
August
on
bank holiday.
Is David Davis going to turn up?
He hasn't said.
He hasn't said.
That's definitely a no, isn't it?
That's a no. Yeah, that's like I didn't get the email.
I missed your text. I think it must have, I don't know, anyway.
So, yeah, reception in Shropshire, in my country seat of Shropshire or whatever. Yeah. Okay. So David, we'll have to wait for tomorrow to know whether the
early morning
plane lands in Paris or Brussels or wherever it's happening.
Yeah, if not, Tuesday.
Okay.
Brexit can wait. Who cares?
Yeah.
Other people, there's just politicians on tour. We've got...
On tour?
Yeah.
Well, like on cruise ships, retired politicians.
No, current, yeah. Well, Theresa
with
May...
Alan Lamb.
Theresa May's just come back from, where was she? She was in, like, Switzerland or somewhere.
Yeah, hiking in Switzerland.
She was
hiking. She likes that, yeah.
She's on her first official trip to Japan to talk
That's
to Shinzo
right.
Abe about defence and security cooperation and... Obviously, trade. We're going to need all the trade we can get if David Davis gets his act together.
Anyway, Bill, what's next?
Well, we did more politicians. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, first ever foreign trip. He's severed ties with Israel, and he's off to Turkey. So that should be nice for him. He'll be back, though, in time for Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, who is trying to reignite the peace talks. And then we've got Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who's off to the Middle East, Qatar.
He racks up a lot of air miles.
He is really... He's got his passport. Must be. Do they stamp passports of foreign ministers?
Of course.
Or have they got like a diplomatic one?
I think you don't kind of go in the normal queue.
Right.
You're not. It's not the Ryanair, the 540 Ryanair from Stansted. But you definitely get your passport stamped still. You can't avoid that.
Okay. So yeah, he's in Qatar, Kuwait and the UAE. To discuss support. This was interesting. It said support for Russia's position and initiatives in a number of areas.
Lots of firm handshaking, probably.
Lots of bit of back touching. After you through the door, bit of photo op stuff, bit of body language watching for the body language experts.
I like the body language of diplomacy.
Yeah, I like that too. I bet old Sergei's got a gold tag on his carry-on baggage to denote a sort of royal air mile connoisseur.
Big time.
Right?
He's probably got his own plane.
Yeah.
Should we do a pitch around? Because they work on the radio.
Yes, that's exactly. This is perfect radio content.
Don't worry. Silly season is yet to disappear.
Okay.
Because tomorrow, Monday, bank holiday Monday here in the UK, it's only the World Gravy Wrestling Championships.
Oh, God.
Two for you.
Let's have a look at this.
Two for you.
Oh, my God.
Wow, this is great. Where does this take place?
This is in Lancashire at the Rose and Bowl. I've watched some videos. But you've got the pictures. Describe what you're seeing.
Well,
it's people wrestling in gravy. I can't say it much fairer than that.
It's pretty grotesque. I've got two ladies here and then two gentlemen, one of whom I think is TV's Rory McGrath.
It looks like him, doesn't it?
The man with a perpetually blocked up nose.
But with a big belly strapped to him.
Yeah. And there's a sort of, I mean, it's done quite correctly, Tom. You can see here a man sort of done up like a sort of boxing referee with a bow tie and the sort of, you know, the sort of smart,
he's the
Saturday night smart.
He's the adjudicator.
Yeah, I've got two chicks in bikinis here, wrestling in gravy. Could be sexier than it sounds, actually.
Yeah, surprisingly unsexy.
Not very,
given you've got partial nudity and meat-based liquid there.
So apparently it's 20,000 gallons of gravy they make up. I'm not sure what make it is. Presumably it's instant. The points aren't for the gravy. It's for fun moves, costumes, and how many laughs you get from the crowd.
I'm surprised that, Tom, you haven't got an outside broadcasting team on this.
We could. Is it too late to...
Where's Daniel Giacopelli? He's normally the one that's on call.
Danny can do that.
He's got his bag packed, hasn't he, next to his front
always
door.
Always ready for it.
Ship him out.
Yeah, this time it's not Davos, Danny. It's the Gravy Wrestling Championships.
In Lancashire.
Get thee up to Lancashire, you!
Right.
And maybe to go with your... lashings of gravy. You're going to have to save some for next Saturday. It's International Bacon Day, boys.
Bacon?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, next Saturday it's bacon
next
day.
Next Saturday.
Okay, so it's a bacon sandwich, classic.
I've got
one of the best bacon and sausage sandwich huts, I think, in London, on the Blackheath, on my doorstep. Very good. As endorsed by Danny Baker, the sort of unofficial mayor of South London, right?
Yeah,
it's properly good stuff. That's where I'll be going.
Okay.
Where will you be enjoying your bacon sandwich? You won't be enjoying one because you're vegetarian.
Well, I'm vegetarian. Okay. Maybe I'll get some of that corn facon.
Facon.
But you're prone to a lapse, Bill, as I understand it, vegetarian-wise.
only on very special occasions. I'm not sure International Bacon
that
Day.
That is surely special.
It doesn't get any more special than that, does
you're
it?
Saying that we should do it, but come on, you've got to... Proof of the...
Okay, well, let's hang out. Let's get some bacon.
Let's get some bacon and some bacon.
What I like about it is the website says it celebrates the... Oh, celebrations typically include social gatherings during which participants create and consume dishes containing bacon, including bacon-themed drinks. What are you going to put bacon in? What drink?
Well, I don't know.
It would be a Bloody Mary.
A stick of incredibly... firmly overcooked
saline
smoky bacon,
yeah.
Streaky bacon,
yeah, good stuff.
You could stir your drink with it. I reckon you could throw that into a martini or something like that. I gather in Las Vegas, Nevada, you can indeed enjoy a bacon martini.
Well, I think that's given our listeners food and drink for thought. Bill Lutie,
bacon not stirred.
Yes. Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Robert Bound. We're going to hear music from Saint-Etienne Rob a little bit later in the programme. But our producer, Tom Hall, he doesn't just stay behind the glass. He gets out and about. And we're going to kick off the show this week hearing a little more from him. He went to meet Saint-Etienne. He went to Green Man Festival, a place I know...
Love it.
...that
know
you
it well.
Are a big fan of. Predictably enough, I may say... The weather was not exactly
kept,
summery,
kept things
as I,
green,
as I understand it.
Yeah.
But a great event and a great chat, which we'll hear in a moment. But why do you like Green Man so much?
Green Man's such a good vibe, Green Man. And people say that, they say, oh, it's good vibes. But there is, it's deeply friendly. It's just big enough to sort of get slightly lost, but not so big. It's not like sort of the military campaign that is Glastonbury. it's deeply friendly, deeply cool, amazing bookers, amazing bands, lovely people. And often some of our own team, as you know, our team Holly and Tom and Bill and Jolene and I think Michaela are all there this year, kind of flying a bit of the Monocle flag and a bit
the
of the
old Monocle.
Let's not sleep for 3 days flag, which is always good as well.
Monocle minibus was up
the Monocle
there.
Minibus.
Anyway, Tom Hall ran into the band, made up of course of Sarah Cracknell, Bob Stanley, and Pete Wiggs at Green Man to talk about their new EP and how to write songs for the summer.
The new EP, Dive, features new tracks and remixes of that song from the likes of Greg Wilson, Colorama, Matt Berry and more. Tom began by asking how they picked remixes for the new EP.
Well, all of us have been fans of Greg Wilson for quite a while. But you made the contact, didn't you, Greg?
Yeah, I just emailed him. That was it.
That's a great story.
Magic of the modern world. He could just like write to him and said, I don't know, I thought, you know, Dive just seemed to... suit him, and you know he's a great DJ, and you know he's been around. God, you know he's been around since the 70s, isn't he? So he's a legend. And but I thought it might be up his street, and I sent him the whole album, thinking he'd probably pick Dive, and he did. I said we could do a remix of anything you want if you fancy it, and he said, well, I wouldn't mind doing Dive. So yeah, that was that. We haven't met him. Hopefully we'll meet him. I know he's played it out already a few times, made an acetate of it, and. It's fantastic. It's kind of like exactly what I was hoping he'd do, which makes it sound like it's a bit predictable. But it's great. It's a great mix.
And these remixes, especially the one you're talking about, the Greg Wilson one, it has this sort of summery, kind of slightly Balearic house kind of thing going on. The lyrics are, you know, summer sun is forever. That's a very, very summery notion. As we sit here in the pouring rain, Sarah, maybe you can tell me about writing songs with a summery flavour. Where does that kind of inspiration, where do you find it on a day like this?
Well, I was about to say, if you look at the colour of me, I've just been in Spain for 3 weeks. But it's actually more about Windsor, weirdly, where home county is. And I used to go with some friends who had a little motorboat. And I used to go into get towed along behind the motorboat in the river And then it was filthy as hell. Imagine what I was drinking at the time. But on a sunny day,
without the skis.
Yeah. Yeah, literally just get towed along behind. So there's probably petrol and, rat feet. Oh, God knows. But anyway, it felt very nice and very summery. So it's more about that. But I think the feel of the record itself is really summery. And I've just been in Spain. And I think it would have been a great sort of, Well, it was. We did play it a couple of times, I have to say. A great moment there.
And we've just had a video made for it as well by Esther Johnson, which is filmed in Scarborough, and she had a bit of trouble with the weather as well. It's very influenced by the French New Wave, and it looks fantastic, but she had to really stay there a lot longer, I think, to get some decent days. And it looks brilliant.
Yeah, it's like Yorkshire take on the French New Wave. So the skies are all grey, and she had to grade it to make everything look extremely as colourful as possible. She had the two characters in it are wearing quite bright colours all the way through. But no, it's a great video. There's loads of shots of things that probably won't be there much longer in Scarborough, which I don't know. I've never been to Scarborough. Have any of you two?
I feel like I have now.
Don't need to go now.
Do you think that the British write songs about summer in a slightly different mindset to maybe other nationalities? I mean, because we are not blessed with always the sunniest of summer times. You've got songs like The Kinks' Sunny Afternoon. It's sort of laced with a bit of sort of irony and sarcasm there. I mean, when you guys kind of summon this notion, are you sort of doing it with a bit of a nod and a wink too?
Well, but not deliberately, but I think we're lucky in a sense to experience seasons, and in the winter you look forward to the summer. You know, if you live in California, I'm sure it's kind of a bit more all the same, or, that's why I don't live there.
I think we've actually written songs about all the seasons, which sometimes in winter, it's spring, suburban autumn, lieutenant, yes. So, all the seasons, there we are. Christmas, so it's true, summer. We're definitely influenced by it.
I think when we write summery songs, it's with a dollop of optimism about the sun coming out and remaining for a few weeks, which it does. It was amazing spring and early summer here, and hopefully we'll have a lovely September.
We were at Port Elliot Festival a couple of weeks ago, and some friends of ours from California were over for it, and I thought, and it was raining, and normally it's really sunny, and it's like, and they loved it. They're going, no, this is totally English, it's brilliant, we love it.
You are musicians, but you're also quite noted pop pickers. Can you tell me, you just played your own little radio show here at Green Man, can you tell me some of your favourite summer songs, some of your favourite sort of songs that do that for you?
Let me think. Off the cuff.
Move Your Feet by Junior Senior. It's a great summer song. Beach Baby by First Class.
Keep going.
Oh, God. Yeah, that'll do for now.
Off the top of my head, I don't know.
Beach Boys, The Warmth of the Sun. That's one, isn't it? Yeah.
That's good because it's a melancholy one as well.
Yeah.
Warmth of the Sun. Well, lots of the Beach Boys summer songs are melancholy.
There are loads of songs that don't even mention some or summer that you hear, like sort of Balearic anthems that make you think of the sun.
Yeah.
It's actually a very different thing, isn't it? As a song that evokes a summery feeling and a song about summer, two completely different things, as you're saying. I mean, and like you say with the Beach Boys, I mean, there is a real strange, almost demented darkness to some of their songs that still have that strange melodic feeling. When you guys make albums, I mean, are you aware of like a duality in your music? Not maybe so much the insanity of Brian Wilson, but other things that come out of the songs when you re-listen to them maybe later in time. Are you aware of that?
Yeah, well, there's often, almost an intentional. Sometimes if you've written some chord sequence that sounds a bit jolly, you think, well, I need to temper this with some miserable lyrics. Not miserable.
Twisted lyrics. Yeah. Yeah, more twisted lyrics. So you do kind of, but melancholy is the perfect mood for a song, in our opinion. I think in my opinion, but nodding. So in our opinion, and it's the bittersweet thing. It's like Dancing Queen or something like that. But things can sound jolly, but with a darker lyric.
It's funny. Sometimes they exist for quite a long time as music with a melody, but without the words, and then it's never complete until we've added the words. And some do you forget that ever existed, the separation, that it becomes a thing once you've done it, and you're like, and it, to me, sometimes it creates pictures in my mind that weren't necessary there when we were writing it, but it, you know, it takes on a life of its own.
And then finally, we're here at Green Man, and PJ Harvey is going to take the stage in sheets of rain, I think, sadly, on the main stage. You guys, you were talking it up a little bit earlier on your radio show, quite smugly, I think. You guys are inside in a tent. Do you think that PJ would swap shoes with you tonight?
I don't know. Sarah played a festival a couple of years ago. She was in a tent, and the tent got flooded, so anything can happen.
Sarah, come on, tell us about that.
I was at Port Elliot, and what it was that it's on an estuary, and there was a spring tide, no, not spring tide, anyway, moon thing, lunar thing, and all this water washed in, went straight into this tent where the generator was for the stage I was on, and everything went, ooh, like that. We couldn't play any more songs for about an hour, I think, or 45 minutes. So, yeah, anything can happen, especially in this kind of rain. It's pretty torrential.
Saint Etienne there, talking to the Monocle Weekly's producer Tom Hall earlier at Green Man Festival in Wales. And their new Dive EP is out in September.
And here it is.
I prefer the Bob Wilson remix.
An Arsenal legend. I knew you'd love him, Tom. Monocle's four-part summer nightmare. Can I say that? Can I say that that's accidental?
No, do it. It's fine.
No, just do it. It's good.
And a big part of what we're trying to show readers is the best food and travel that can be enjoyed throughout the summer.
So who better to talk us through what's in the latest issue than Monocle's food and travel editor, Josh Fennett?
What an excitement to be here on the Weekly. I can't believe it.
That was quite a funny little intro you gave there. It was really... And here he is, like, ushering in a sort of prize...
Heifer. Big old heifer.
At a county show. That is one of the subjects that you were writing about in this week's summer thing. Why is it funny? That's funny. Can I say also one of the reasons we were laughing so much is because we have to give credit where it's due to Andrew Tuck, our esteemed editor and sometime co-host of this programme, for the astounding milk-based pun on the front page of Section 3 of the newspaper. Would you like to reveal all, Josh?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's totally beautiful. I mean, one of the nice things about this newspaper is that it gives a lot of real estate to...
Moosepaper,
as we call it. is it gives a lot of good real estate to amazing photography. And there's just a nice picture of three, I believe they're Guernseys. Mm. I believe you can tell that from the slightly darker patches on the face. But these like beautiful Channel Island cows, which is a story that we'll come onto in a minute. And our editor, in his wisdom, has given one of the cows a speech bubble. And he's saying, lay, lady, lay across my big grass bed.
Lay as in the French for milk.
Exactly.
Beautifully done, Andrew Tuck.
And the Bob Dylan quote to boot. And it kicks things off nicely and sets a bit of a tone for what we have inside, a bit of the levity that lies within the pages of the summer newspaper.
So what is this story that we're talking about? You met these three beautiful daisies on a trip down to Somerset, which is sort of a pretty rare kind of place to go for my collection. And long let continue, this sort of agrarian revolution that we're having at the newspaper.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we pride ourselves on having reporters on all corners of the world and all different cities. You know, we've reported from Mosul and we've reported from...
Flat whites taste the same everywhere, it seems.
Well, that's exactly true. And there's no reason that dairy farmers, people who've, let's face it, had some pretty sour luck over the past few years... There's a real excess of production and lots of family farms are going out of business. So we decided to pay a visit to one that was kind of up on its luck for once, that's been connected to the London coffee scene, and we all know coffees are extremely expensive in London, by two entrepreneurs who are connecting decent milk with great coffee shops and actually paying the farmers fairly, which is, a nice sunny story. And, you know, if it's found in rural Somerset, then we'll take it.
I absolutely love this story.
Yeah, it's great.
I think it's brilliant. And what's good about it is precisely as you said, Josh, it connects businesses that share a sort of a broader interest. And it proves, almost definitively, that also businesses and the end consumer are indeed happy to pay a premium to get something that has, you know, good, decent provenance and its quality. I think it's a... Everyone seems to win with this. That's why I like it.
Yeah, I mean, that no one's saying that it could take place on a massive scale and that all of the woes of European farmers are going to be solved by a couple of upstarts, you know, shipping milk into London from Bristol.
But I wonder if it would... I wonder, actually, with Brexit, this is would become much more of a viable thing. I think, actually, it could work, you know.
I think totally it is. And another interesting thing is that the beautiful kind of toffee-coloured Channel Island cows that produce this milk are pretty special, Rob. Produce a bit less than the Frisians and the Holsteins, for sure. But actually...
he said that as I was jockeying there for the Frisian.
We all know where your predilections lie. and these guys basically make a much richer milk, and the treatment of the milk is slightly different. And I've bought into the studio, and I'm concealing underneath a vast
newspaper.
I saw you come in with them.
And
you just thought I was thirsty, didn't I?
Yeah, exactly. And we sort of Tom whispered under his breath when you walked in, "There's Milky Fennet." Which I thought was a bit of a... I didn't quite know what he meant.
No one does.
You look like you spilt something down your trousers.
We've agreed that it's abhorrent, but we don't know why.
No.
But tell us more, because presumably you sampled the
wares. So let's have a look at this stuff.
Did you sample the wares?
So I did. So I bought this back from Somerset.
From the cow?
I bought this back from... not direct from the cow, no, sadly not. But I bought it back from Somerset. It's been, you know, sitting under my desk for a couple of weeks, just fermenting, getting really tasty. But I wonder if you, Tom Edwards, first of all...
So naturally sparkling milk.
You can taste the difference between the milk, which is sold by these guys, the Estate Dairy.
Yep.
And some normal skimmed from the Midori House fridge.
Can I take a punt before I even try it and just do it by sight?
We'll show you working out, but yes.
Okay, this is obviously the posh new sexy milk, and this is the horrible mass market.
What's making you think that? The fact the level's lower, you think I've had a sip on the way in.
Yeah. No, but we should say, it looks more viscous, and it is a different colour.
A yellow creaminess to
it has that
butter
sort of,
milk.
And it just looks more like an organic, healthy-looking...
So you've hit on it. So basically, the higher butterfat content of the Channel Island cows means they produce less milk, but of a kind of a greater frothiness. Which
Do you want me to try the milk?
Yeah, try it. And it's also that golden colour, and it's because these cows can't digest a certain type of keratin that you find in carrots, which gives it the orange flavour.
So actually, smells of cow.
Sorry, I was handling it with a dirty hand.
Do you know what?
Sort of steak.
That is an entirely unlike the sort of your run of the mill, even posh organic milk from the supermarket. Completely different.
Yeah, it's sweet, isn't it? It's good to have the fat, isn't it? Yeah. Really lovely.
Yeah, it's very tasty. And, you know, this isn't a solution for the dairy industry where people are getting ripped off. Basically, you know, you learn that supermarkets are paying 25 pence a litre and it's costing farmers 25 pence a litre to make the milk. Mm. The beauty of this is people in London, they'll pay anything for anything, won't they?
Idiots.
Exactly. Absolute buffoons to a man. What and how? So how much do these? So sorry, what's the name of this company?
So they're called the Estate Dairy. It's two young guys called Sean Young and Rebecca Young, partners but not married, just coincidental, same last name.
Really? Yeah. God, how many times have they said that, do you think, to people?
Very often. Well, the great irony of this is I went down to this beautiful kind of ramshackle cottage in the heart of Somerset, to Bickfield Farm.
Yeah.
And I sat round a rather beautiful kind of checkered tablecloth in a cluttered farm kitchen. With a third generation farmer, a guy called Morris Durbin, and he can't stand coffee. He said, "I call it frothy coffee, and I have to cross the road when I smell it." But ironically, that's the thing floating his business, and, you know, meaning that the price for litre has gone way up for just a few farms that supply the Estate Dairy at the minute. But they're delivering 40,000 litres a week to different places in London, which is a logistical nightmare.
I wonder what their truck. I wonder what their truck looks like. Do they just use a sort of old Unigate truck, or do they have a nice sort of branded one?
That'd be nice. There's no branding on the trucks currently.
And then what do these bottles of milk look like?
There's a picture in the paper.
Yeah, I know.
There's a picture. So the way that the business model works is a lot more focused towards the trade. So they're shipping these off to restaurants. They're shipping them off to coffee shops.
So this isn't a Waitrose purchase. This is a wholesale purchase.
Funny you should mention that, Rob, because very soon I think they're going to launch the 1 liter bottle, which is going into Selfridges. They're talking about chocolate milks, Rob. They're talking about cultured butters.
That would be...
There's all sorts of exciting
dynamite
things in the pipeline.
It's good. Did you have a go at milking?
I didn't. They wouldn't let me get near it, unfortunately.
Really?
Yeah,
really? Why?
I don't know. They saw the look in my eye.
You looked at Daisy and had a frisky, well, uncontrollable look in your eye.
Unfortunately, Rob, you're a sort of bucolic fellow, aren't you?
Yes,
you
grew up very much
so. You grew up in the countryside.
Yeah.
But basically, the milking rooms are quite scary places. So yeah. Your head is at about buttock height of the cow.
Yeah.
And there's all these
fart
kind of
height. it's technical.
Yeah,
name,
yeah, exactly that. So you need to be very careful. The woman doing it was wearing a sort of overall. I was there in my sort of, you know, fashionable jacket and a pair of Stan
We're
Smiths.
We're not from London, he said.
Slightly muddied Stan Smiths from walking across the field in the spitting rain.
Yeah.
And I wasn't up for it.
You didn't bring a nice pair of hunters?
I borrowed a pair of Morris's, actually,
okay.
Later in the day.
Good.
So, Josh, you're not just the food and drink man. You're the travel editor, of course, as well, and travel more than well catered for in this same third section of the newspaper.
So we got lots of beautiful travel stories in the paper. One I particularly liked, but sensed an ulterior motive in, is a story about Tivoli, which is a beautiful town in upstate New York, a place where people in the Big Apple go to escape the balmy temperatures in town. And it's basically this beautiful little village on the lakes to the east of the Catskills. But I have my suspicions. The writer, Charles McFarlane, out of our New York office, actually has some friends there, so I'm not sure whether...
Do you think it was just an excuse for him to have a bit of a knees up with his buddies.
Is this a sincerely held piece of reportage you thought the world needed, or an excuse to see friends? Hard to know, but the result
I think the two are always the same thing.
That's very much the Rob Bound commissioning policy on the magazine, isn't it?
But that looks like a beautiful place, a place I'd like to visit. Is that where Bard College is?
That's exactly where Bard College is.
We did a story on this right in, I think, year one of Monocle, and it's a kind of gorgeous, glorious place. Bard College, obviously, sort of, you know, of great kind of cultural and actual riches. It's a cool, and I think it's a wonderful drive up there. I think it's all sorts of good, especially almost, I'd have thought it's really good in the winter as well.
Yeah, totally. But the towns in upstate New York have been increasingly colonised by, you know, huffy people that are leaving the city saying, you know, I can't be bothered to get the subway all day. Mm. I'm going to go, you know, start an organic farm. I'm going to go, you know, pitch in a restaurant. And the interesting thing about Tivoli as a destination that makes it different from, say, Hudson, which is a lot bigger, is it's only got 1,000 people in it, but it has, as you say, this august institution. It has, you know, Frank Gehry architecture. It has beautiful Italianate gardens and also a kind of small town feel. You can't get there by train. There's one road in, one road out. And that creates a sense of kind of separateness and a sense of identity that's been allowed to bubble up, and which means that it's still an interesting place to visit. There's lots of other beautiful travel stories. One thing that we've done for the past 4 weeks is we've taken a bit of a step back on the idea that holidays need to just be recommendations of where to go. And we've talked about where people went in the past and the kind of the forging of places like the French Riviera, which we all think of as kind of the stomping ground of the Fitzgeralds and the American tourists that came in the 20s and 30s. But we got a rather good writer and an academic to talk about the British aristocracy who forged what was important about it when Queen Victoria went down with her, led by her donkey Jacquot.
Oh, I like that.
With a couple of weeks' supply of Irish stew.
Yeah, of course. That was just for what, presumably a day of big Vic's big intake, wasn't it?
Yeah, I assume so.
It
talks to the fact that holidays are, you know, our birthright, and it's great to get away, and isn't it nice to see a sandy beach? But also, like, people's leisure time has always had a historic impact on the places where they visited, the influx of people, the kind of rubbing together of cultures. Is also something we've tried to look at in a bit more of a roundabout way, a bit of a sideways view.
One of the things I really like in your section is the subway holiday. Is it called that?
Yeah, it is. I mean,
it is at the bottom. It's a simple idea, well done, isn't it? What subway line? It's a real thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So the idea is that, unfortunately, and we're experiencing it in the Monocle offices right here in Midori House. You know, you don't always get to go on holiday exactly when you want to, like for the month of August. Perhaps you'll be composing a paper in your spare time
and
your real time.
Yeah.
And the idea is that you might be able to, you know, from the centre of your city, get to somewhere that feels like you've escaped, and you can do it in a day. And you don't have to do all the country things like wading through the Durban's farm, asking to borrow a pair of wellies. You know, there's culture, there's art, and there are beautiful things in and around our cities. So this week we've gone to Hong Kong. We sent James Chambers off on the Kwu Tong line. So the idea is that you can escape. So we did Vienna 1 week. You know, when we were talking about London, we talked about, you know, isn't it nice? You know, London is great, but it can be a bit oppressive.
And Josh, there's still one more newspaper to go. What delights await in what, the fourth instalment? Can you whet the listeners' appetites a little?
I think I'd better not, for fear that the stories may be killed or fall apart and disappoint our dear readers. But if the reception that we've had for the newspaper so far, the way that we're able to treat these stories with a greater immediacy, give them more kind of delights on the page, blow up some of the pictures, and also devote a lot of text and reporting to what goes in, I think the readers will be sated with what we've come up with, let's say.
Well, thank you very much for leading us merrily to the editorial pasture. With your cows and everything else besides Josh Fennett. Thank you very much indeed. Emiko Davies is an Australian-Japanese food writer living in Italy, but whose early life was also spent in China and the USA. Her recent book, Aquacotta Recipes and Stories from Tuscany's Secret Silver Coast, collects some of the Mediterranean region's best culinary traditions. So we thought, who better to tell us a little bit more about the dishes to cook for a summer get-together, whether both in Italy or around the globe.
And she joins us now, I'm very happy to say, from Tuscany. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Emiko. Very good to speak with you. Tell us a little bit about, I don't know, the specific magic then of the foods from the Tuscan region. What is it about that area that's so enduringly compelling, do you think?
Well, for me, this part of Tuscany is a really different part of Tuscany from the one that people really know probably quite well. We're talking about the very, very southernmost part of Tuscany and really just a little sort of sliver of the coast and a tiny little bit inland, just on the border of Lazio. So it's quite different to what you find in Florence or Siena or Pisa. And most of it obviously is sort of influenced by the sea that's there and also the mountains. It's a really sort of rugged, wild, hilly kind of area, but really, really different to, you know, the classic Chianti and Florentine hills.
Just so people get an instant idea and get their taste buds racing, Emiko, what is sort of one of the kind of couple of key ingredients of the more sort of southern Tuscan Roman cuisine than the northern stuff, the Chianti shear that perhaps some of our listeners will be familiar with?
You'll find a lot of things that come out right out of the woods. So mushrooms, wild mushrooms. Then you've got the things that are coming out of the sea, but also there's a really beautiful lagoon called Orbitello. And so you've got things like eel and other fish that are naturally found in the lagoon there. So it's a sort of combination of seafood and things like mushrooms, but also wild game, because as I said, it's really sort of very much more rugged and wild than places like the Chianti. So you've got lots of things like wild boar and deer and that sort of thing that you can find in that area. It's sort of very rustic country cooking.
Well, I was going to ask you about this because the picture, I mean, I'm just leafing through the book now. It's making me hungry just looking at these delicious pictures and reading the recipes and your descriptions of these various parts of the world. But there's definitely something rustic. There's clearly this, as you said, this the seafood. There's something quite sort of honest about the cuisine. But I guess that doesn't mean that it's lacking in complexity, right? I mean, tell us a little bit more about how the sort of the balance of some of the dishes is struck.
A lot of the dishes from this part of Tuscany is called the Maremma. And Maremma is actually quite big, so I'm going to talk about Maremma, but really I'm talking about this sliver of the Maremma as well. It's an area where there were a lot of farmers, so contadini, they're called farmers, and fishermen, and so it's not like wealthy recipes, wealthy cooking. It really does come from the cucina povera type cuisine, so that literally means like peasant cuisine. But as you just said, it's not, doesn't mean that it's poor in sort of flavour. It's really really very tasty, interesting food. And I really think that the cucina povera cuisine, they really knew how to make the most out of the ingredients that they had on hand and create these really exquisite, really delicious dishes. So you have things like, there's a dish called pollo in aceto, which is just a chicken stew. It's cooked with vinegar, which sounds a little bit odd at first, but once you taste it, it's just it's sort of addictive and irresistible. And the vinegar, of course, is an ingredient that helps conserve the dish longer, so it helps conserve the meat. And you'll find a lot of things like that, so smoked eel or eel that's been fried and then marinated in vinegar, and quite a lot of added herbs and spices that you don't see as commonly in the rest of Tuscany. So they like the use of chili, for example. So you've got quite a bit of chili. There's always a bit of garlic in there. So everything is really quite flavourful.
If anyone can hear a strange sound, it's not interference on the line. That's my stomach rumbling. Every dish sounds delicious, doesn't it, Roy?
Pretty good stuff. And it's a beautiful book, Emiko, as well. Tell us about that. I know you've got a sort of art history background. You have an aesthetic sense as much as a sort of culinary one. I like the way you've put the book together. It is not glossy, but it's very stylish. I like the kind of illustrations of some of the ingredients, the field and fowl and fauna and all the rest of it that go in your recipes. How long did it take to cook up the book design?
Well, the entire thing from start to finish was probably about 18 months. I didn't do the design, but I did do the drawings of the ingredients, the mushrooms and the fish and that sort of thing. And I did the photographs of the places that you see throughout the book. Those were all based on basically 6 months of living in that area in a town called Porto Ercole. So 6 months worth of photographs put together along with the recipes.
And Emiko, let me tell you, I mean, this is probably a bit of a difficult question to ask, but is there a particular place, I know you sort of touched upon this in the book, really, a particular place, a particular dish, even a particular moment that for you encapsulates the very essence of, you know, aquacotta and everything you're talking about in the book? Is it a particular vista from a particular, you know, terrace at a particular restaurant at a particular time of day? Or are there just too many gems to choose from to pick out one that seems to dilute everything down to that perfect moment?
That's really hard to answer in one. But for me, I mean, I would say for me personally, it's a combination of things. Can I say that?
Very nicely done. Do you know that Emiko's father's a diplomat? It says it in our notes. I can see why. I can see how that works out. Tell us a little bit about the very long story, the backstory, Emiko, to this, because you obviously had a fairly itinerant childhood. Japanese, Australian, and China and the United States as well goes in there. Is this the best place in the world you've eaten food, though?
No, that's pretty hard to say. It is one of the best places that I've had certain ingredients. Like the fresh seafood is just incredible. And things like the botarga that they make there is some of the best botarga I've ever tasted. The melons that come from that part of Tuscany are the sweetest I've ever tasted. But mum's cooking probably is, I have to say, the best one. But in terms of the ingredients and some of the things that I've tasted in this little part of the Maremma, it's really unique, really, really unique.
And Emiko, just tell me, maybe finally, you know, there's lots of other cliches about Italian cuisine and maybe the cuisine of the region, but you often get the sense, and I guess through reading the book and through the way you write about your personal consumption and preparation of the food, that they're all dishes best served with and for and by family. Is there something true to that? Do you think this idea that this is where families get together and sit around the table, is that the only real authentic way to enjoy the cuisine of the region?
For me, these are all dishes that I really feel like sort of serve a crowd, you know. So many of them, you wouldn't sort of make it just for one person, you know. You really want to be, if you're spending sort of time and effort putting together like a seafood stew or one of the other, the wild boar stew or anything like that, if you've gone out and hunted mushrooms and then you're just coming back to toss it through some pasta, even that, you usually come back with a big load of mushrooms, or you come back with loads and loads of seafood and you put them all in a pot. It really equates to a sort of a big dish to feed many people at once. So I immediately feel like that equates to you've got a large table of people waiting to be fed. And in many, many ways, that's really typical of that area, but also of the sort of the family recipes. This is the kind of food that you would find in a home rather than in a restaurant or a trattoria. Of course, many of them you still do find in a trattoria as well, but I had to dig up some recipes that were really only found through talking to people, because you couldn't find them anymore in a restaurant or anything like that. So, I feel like these are best dishes that are best shared amongst a big table.
Well, our mouths are watering. We must to lunch ourselves. Our thanks to Emiko Davies, the brains and the wooden spoon behind Aquacotta, recipes and stories from Tuscany's secret silver coast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And that is it. That is edition 425 of the Monocle Weekly, Tom. I thoroughly enjoyed today's episode, as I always do. It's made me very hungry. for summer.
There's some good foodie yeah, chat. And exactly. But there was what would you call it? Cultural sustenance as well included.
Cultural sustenance. Saint-Étienne are fantastic living legends, aren't they, really? Lovely chat from Tom there at the Green Man Festival. Bit jealous I wasn't there last weekend, but never mind. Emiko Davies, she's made me hungry. And Josh just, you know, always kills it, doesn't he?
He does.
And eats it.
Milky.
Yeah, milky fennet. Let's get out of Alison's faces, shall we? Let's do it. Let's thank our pals behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, researched by Audrey Fyodorenko, and our studio manager is Cassie Galpin. The Monocle will be back at the same time, same place next week, but the time being from me, Robert Barnes.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.